Welcome to the Green World Pavilion. This panel is Why Change the Military? New Adversaries, New Technologies, and a New Generation of Soldiers. Good morning, I'm Greg Bangs. I'm with Booz Allen Hamilton. I'd just like to go over a few housekeeping notes. Please shut off your cell phones and or Blackberries or switch them to vibrate. And when we get to the question and answer session, you'll note that there's microphones in the two aisles here. Our moderator will instruct you to go to those. So keep that in mind, please. And now I'd like to introduce our moderator. Lloyd Howell is the vice president for Booz Allen Hamilton. He's the firm's leader of organization and strategy, which focuses on the organization, design, and efficiency, strategic human capital, learning systems, and change management service offerings. He supports a variety of civil, security, and Department of Defense clients. Lloyd has co-authored several industry-related articles, including The Military Millennials, which relates to the subject at hand. Now, with that, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Lloyd Howell. Lloyd?
Thank you, Greg. Today's panel discussion is a very timely discussion. And to talk about the topic, we have the following panelists with us today. To my immediate right, we have Jim Steinberg, the dean of the J.J. Jake Pickle Regents Chair at the LBJ School down at the University of Texas at Austin. Previously, a vice president and director of foreign policy at Brookings Institute, and he served as a deputy national security advisor to President Clinton, and has also served in the State Department as the chief of staff. He's authored many books on foreign policy and national security topics, including Protecting the Homeland, 2006-2007, and An Even Closer Union, European Integration and Its Implications for the Future of U.S.-European Relations. Continuing with Admiral Gary Ruffhead, he is the 29th Chief of the Naval Operations. Previously served as Commandant for the United States Naval Academy, Chief of Legislative Affairs for the Department of Navy, and Deputy Commander for the U.S. Pacific Command. He is one of only two officers to have commanded the fleets in the Pacific and the Atlantic, and he was a commander of the U.S. Fleet Forces, where he was responsible for ensuring Navy forces were trained, ready, equipped, and prepared to operate around the world, where and when needed. He has received numerous awards, including the Defense Distinguished Service Medal, Navy Distinguished Service Medal, Defense Superior Service Medal, and the Legion of Merit. When he was the deputy commander of PACOM, he was heavily involved in the tsunami relief effort in Indonesia late December, early January 2005. Since then, he has worked to include the humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, and the Navy's maritime strategy as a way to codify these activities. And then lastly, we have Bob Kaplan. He is a national correspondent for The Atlantic, a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. And he has reported for the magazine from Europe, Africa, the Middle East, Asia, Latin America, and the United States. He has also authored numerous books to include Hog Pilots, Blue Water Grunts, The American Military in the Air, At Sea, On the Ground, as well as And a Balkan Ghost, A Journey Through History, all of which grew out of the Atlantic articles, and he has been writing as a foreign correspondent for more than 20 years. Welcome, gentlemen. The transformation of our military is not new. In the late 90s, General Sasaki, head of the Army at the time, had initiated a program of transformation. Secretary Rumsfeld is also, during his tenure, focused on transformation of the military, really focusing on quick and rapid responses given the changing nature of the threat. Despite this decade of efforts, many changes are still pressing. In light of challenges that we face as a military today, and expanding, restructuring, monitorizing our U.S. ground forces. Not the least of which is an article on a topic that two of my colleagues and I wrote about, the growing millennial generation, or Generation Y. 75 million strong, larger than Gen X, and comparable in size to the baby boomers. Really never have grown up without internet capability or access, view information as something to be shared widely, are very strong at being able to multitask, and are highly tolerant of diversity and commitment to family, community, which really brings a can-do spirit. When we think about the transformational opportunities going forward, a lot of it is driven by two tensions that our panel will discuss today. One focused on restructuring as well as re-equipping the military in ways that leverage a rapidly changing security environment and enemy. Today's nature of warfare is different as we see play out every day in the news. It continues to be in urban settings, and there's rapid increase in the cyberspace. Rethinking our size and structure of a transformed force is also apparent, and we hope to get into that today as well. The role of the individual has been recognized by Defense Secretary Gates as being critical and underscoring the importance of the human factor in current wars as we observe the nature of the threat today. The types of military systems that we apply are also changing. We're fighting adversaries that are both in the cyber world as well as on the ground. We're leveraging unmanned vehicles as well as applying capabilities that are rapidly changing. What I'd like to do is ask each of our panelists to share a few remarks before we get into some Q&A. Jim?
Thanks, and thank you all for coming. It's a fascinating and very rich topic, and that's a really good introduction. There's so many different features that one can talk about in trying to understand what the transformation and the challenges are. I just want to focus on three developments that I think have a really profound implication for our military, both in terms of how we organize, what kinds of individuals we have, and what our overall strategy is. I think the first is the transformation of the whole idea of a battlefield. We sort of think about the military as coming to do set-piece wars in which militaries confront militaries, and all the strategy is around the kind of studying old battles and the like. But when we look at the world today, we're now seeing a spectrum of engagement for the military which is really quite dramatically different than that ideal-type model. Not only do we have, at the one end, the possibility of a real big war, as we saw with the 1991 Gulf War, but what we're seeing now is a lot of focus on counterinsurgency warfare and the like, as we see both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And for me, perhaps even more important is this idea with the global war on terrorism that the whole world is a battlefield and that potentially anywhere in the world our military may need to operate, even in countries that we don't think of as being adversaries. In the old days, you had a sort of sense that there were kind of places where wars were going on that the military fought, and that there were other kinds of situations that perhaps we used paramilitary forces or the CIA to deal with these kinds of problems. But increasingly, we're asking our military to take on these special function forces, to go to the Philippines to fight Abu Sayyaf, to go to different parts of the world in which they're operating almost in a kind of individualized covert action type operation. And this raises tremendous challenges both for how we train and equip, how we think about the military engaging in places where they're actually conducting operations in countries that aren't our adversaries, what our expectations are about them in terms of what kind of legal protections they have, what's the right balance between the activities of the CIA and the traditional covert operations and these special forces. So that's one great transformation, I say, this idea of a global battlefield in which the military might be deployed anywhere, even where there's not a hot war. The second is this incredibly deep interpenetration between the civilian and the military in our operations abroad. We no longer have a situation where the military goes in, does the fight, turns it over to the civilian, says, we're done, now you guys take charge of the post-war phase. There's been no more dramatic example than what we've seen in Iraq about the danger of having a situation where the military and the civilian are disconnected. But in most of our operations now, we see this close connection in the Balkans, where we went in trying to both stabilize a peace, to try to create a security environment, but also try to build a society. And more our military both being asked to take on roles that are related to what some people call nation building, building civil society, building the infrastructure, schools, hospitals, and the like. I mean, it wasn't that many years ago when our current Secretary of State, in criticizing the Clinton administration, said that the army, the military, shouldn't be escorting children to school, and yet we see this happening around the world. And we also need to think about how these different components of our national power, the civilian, the military, the assistance programs, the police who go in to help create a stable environment after the hot war is over, are working together. And we don't really, these are two cultures that are very different. Our military are trained in one set of approaches. Our civilians are not another. There's a lot of discussion now about whether we should have something like the Goldwater-Nichols approach, in which we have the military spending time learning what the civilians do and vice versa, developing new structures so that we get a better integration. But I think this is going to be one of the big challenges going forward. And the third area of transformation is technology, and I know we're going to talk a lot about it, but the one I just want to highlight is we have this very kind of curious disjuncture now between, on the one hand, technology making it possible to conduct very antiseptic military operations. We can operate from a distance. We can send, you know, B-2 bombers from the United States all the way to battlefields far away without, and can, you know, drop the bombs from 30,000 feet and never actually have to be in the theater. We have remote piloted vehicles. We use technology that kind of takes us ability to sort of not be there in the, on the ground dealing with the situation. At the same time, we're conducting operations like we did in Afghanistan, where we have soldiers on horseback fighting as if it were the 18th or 17th century, where we are on the ground conducting these counterinsurgency operations, where it's as much on the human level of engagement, where the technology may give us some advantages, but it's very much a human and personal thing. And how do we train and prepare our soldiers, our sailors, our airmen to deal with that kind of environment where you have these two very, very different approaches to how technology is used and how they engage in military activities?
Thank you. Admiral.
Thanks. Well, it's great to be here, and I thank you for coming. This is my second trip to Colorado in about 4 months, and my staff is becoming concerned that I'm taking climate change too seriously. You know, I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk about this topic, and as I thought about it, I said to myself that the military cannot not change. But the military also has a great history of change, of adapting technology, and adapting different methods of conducting operations, conducting warfare, because at the end of the day, the military that our country invests in must be able to do just that. But I'll talk about some other things that are part of our strategy. But as I look at the landscape, if you will, and what has to be taken into consideration with respect to change, first off, technology easily jumps to mind because that's where we see dramatic changes in capability. And we're sometimes wowed, I would even say overly wowed, by the technology. Demographics are another. Demographics in areas where we will operate. But for someone who is responsible for manning and training and equipping your Navy, demographics of this nation are extraordinarily important to me, and I'll talk a bit about that. And then the rest is just the global landscape on which we will operate, and trying to bring all of those together in such a way that we can maintain a military that is ready to conduct the operations today, but also a military that is making the appropriate investments to build the military of tomorrow so that future leaders have options. We will not get it right. There is not a point target, to use the military vernacular, that will be the right answer for tomorrow's military. But we must get it to where future leaders have options from the toolkit, from the training, from the concepts that we deliver. As I look back over the past and we talk about change or transformation, to me, some of the most significant changes have not been technological. The most significant transformational change that has undertaken the military in my life, and perhaps even a time before that, was the U.S. military becoming an all-volunteer force. That has been the biggest transformational action, I believe, that we have taken, because it has transformed how society views the military. It has transformed the nature of the soldier, the sailor, the airman, the marine, or the Coast Guardsman, and in that they are now an all-volunteer force. The other change that has taken place that has affected how we operate our military and how we wage war was back in the early 80s with Goldwater-Nichols, when we became a more joint force, a force that was much more capable of operating in a mixed and integrated way. As a young officer, when these changes were taking place, I wrote countless point papers that now it's in my best interest to shred because I was predicting the fall of the U.S. military as we knew it. But it really has changed how we operate our forces and what we do with those forces. And to me, it's a precursor of one of the changes that we are undergoing now, that we must be more aggressive in our approach in the future, and Jim touched on it, is moving beyond the integration of our military forces and integrating them into other agencies within our government and other activities and other organizations globally. That is the biggest change, and I can say that it's probably more challenging than what Goldwater Nichols put in front of us. But I'd like to talk about demographics for a moment. When I look at and try and look into my very murky crystal ball about delivering these options for the future, I think it's important to look at economies, and it's important to look at demographics, because I think they tend to portend where some of the issues may be that we as a nation will find ourselves involved, engaged, or at least interested. So as I look at global shifts around the world, that's important. But for me, as the leader of your Navy, the demographics of this country are extremely important to me. If you line up the United States Navy and you look at it, it reflects the face of this nation in gender, in race. If you ask the leadership of that military to step forward, it transforms the image dramatically, and it looks like a lot of white men. If you look at our senior governmental executives that serve in the military, it's that same image. It does not reflect the face of the nation. And if you look forward to 2050, that leadership cadre that is arrayed in front of you is not the demographic of the United States. And now is the time where we have to start looking at those policies, those initiatives that can attract, recruit, and retain the leadership and the military that this nation will look at and see itself and have confidence in it. And then that military has to be competent to be able to go engage in the interest of this nation. So I look forward to the discussions and to the questions. Thank you, Lord.
Thank you. Bob.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. It's my first visit to Aspen for 38 years. 38 years ago, I hitchhiked through here. And the altitude bothered me a lot less then, I can tell you. When we talk about transformation, we should be careful. An engaging military writer, Ralph Peters, wrote that the most transformational weapon of our time has been the suicide bomber, who for a few cents on the dollar has been able to cause the U.S. military to spend billions of dollars. And that's real cost-effective fighting. It's not just a matter of how we transform ourselves, it's how the enemy is reacting to it. We call it the revolution in military affairs. For the enemy, it's the it's the counter-revolution in military affairs. It's what the enemy can do. And for the cost of a few $100,000, look at what al-Qaeda accomplished on 9/11, in terms of the amount of money it costs us to spend. Now, we can't get that efficient in terms of our weapon system because, unlike al-Qaeda, we're not focused on a simple destructive goal, that's very specific. For instance, our Navy has to guard the sea lanes. 70, 80, 90% of goods, even in a jet age, travel by sea. Without the U.S. Navy, there is no globalization because the Straits of Malacca, are unsafe. Without the U.S. Navy and Air Force, all these sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf are, forget about it, because all these Gulf countries, their safety is being implicitly protected by the Navy and Air Force. So we have to do a lot of things. And the Pentagon does not have the luxury of planning for one future of war. It has to hedge and plan for several futures of war. On the one hand, as Jim said, for decades and centuries, we had a very small battlefield with a lot of troops inside of it, and that was the essence of mass infantry warfare. Now you have a very large battlefield spread over third world deserts, seas, jungles in the southern Philippines and in eastern Colombia, etc., and you have small numbers, platoon-size elements, hunting down other platoon-size elements. But at the same time, we have to be compared. We have to be prepared for some sort of conventional conflict on the Korean Peninsula and other things. And because absolute numbers of population are rising on sea level areas in vast urban concentrations where human beings have never lived before in such numbers, you don't even need climate change or global warming. You just need the normal drum roll of climatic variations, and you will get tremendous catastrophes where the U.S. military will be called in to help. Because one thing about the U.S. military is that people may not like it in Iraq or Afghanistan, but the moment there's a catastrophe somewhere, a typhoon in the central Philippines or an earthquake in Pakistan or something, people ask the question, where is the U.S. military? When is it coming to arrive? So the military has to hedge its bets over a whole vast area. And what that means for transformation is how it breaks down with the individual services. There's not one Air Force. There are several Air Force. There's the fighter-bomber community. There's the UAV community. There's the A-10 community. On the one hand, we need long-range strategic bombers for peer competitor threats going 20, 30, 40 years into the future. But on the other hand, we need more unmanned aerial vehicles in Iraq and Afghanistan. And while the Air Force keeps wanting to scrap the A-10, which is like a lumbering World War II B-17-like bomber, we find that in every war we fight, there's a great role for the A-10s. So it's like back to the past, back to the future. In terms of the Navy, we have to be a blue water Navy to project power across the world's oceans and protect the sea lanes. The Navy has to fire from the sea to be able to stand down a threat on land. But it also needs to be a counter-guerrilla force at sea, which is now building up. We may emphasize too much when we talk about transformation land forces, because right now we are involved in two dirty land insurgencies. And we're mounting up two dirty land counterinsurgencies. But the future could be very different. The Franco-Prussian War gave us no insight of what World War I would be like. Korea gave us no insight of what the Vietnam War would be like. The first Gulf War certainly gave us no insight about what the second Gulf War was going to be like. And future wars may contain very large, elements of air and sea and comparatively fewer ground troops. Any strategy for going to war with Iran is mainly air and sea. It's not ground forces for the most part. And I can go on and on. The Army is becoming more special operations force oriented, more small unit oriented. It's changing from big divisions to brigade combat teams. And what that means is a big division has a stodgy, relatively inflexible bureaucratic element. A brigade combat team can shift according to what it's fighting in terms of its bureaucratic element. This has been a big shift for the U.S. Army, and it's very much part of transformation. And it started in the Clinton years and continued through the Rumsfeld years and into the Gates era years. The Navy and the Marines just came out with their Vision and Strategy 2025 statement just a few days ago as we speak. And what that strategy said is that the Marines are going to go back to being soldiers of the sea. They're not just going to be an army desert force, which is what Afghanistan and Iraq have turned them into. They're going to be more amphibious warriors. One thing that's crucial, and I'll end up here, that both the new maritime strategy promulgated by our naval forces last October and the new vision strategy promulgated by the Marines just a few days ago, when you look at where they expect to fight, or rather expect to be engaged, whether it's in fighting, humanitarian relief, whatever, it is going to be increasingly the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific. And those two bodies of water are going to be increasingly linked because of canal possibilities across the Isthmus of Thailand, Dubai Port World building a land bridge across the Isthmus of Thailand, and the Malaysians who want to build oil pipelines that will fundamentally connect the Western Pacific in the Indian Ocean. So even from a geographical standpoint, where we're going to be involved in the future is going to be much more of a naval, aquatic, amphibious environment than perhaps what we've been involved with our two major wars.
Thank you, Bob. One of the things that each of you have mentioned is the new generation, the demographics associated with both attracting kids and folks to enlist in the military. As we all know, it's very competitive, and if you take the insights that we gained in our article on millennials, this is a generation that has lots of choices, lots of opinions of what they would like to do. Gary, when you think about the military competing in this type of environment, what is the value proposition to this generation? How does the military attract this type of individual for not just to fulfill an initial commitment, but for years to come to lead our military?
Thanks, Lloyd, and a great question. I talk about the demographics. One of the things that many in our nation are not aware of is that 28% of the youth in America qualify for military service. That's not 28% for the Navy, that is total. For a variety of reasons, it can be medical, it can be legal, it can be a range of things. So it's a relatively small demographic. But the value proposition for a young man or woman today is the opportunities that they have. The opportunities for leadership are unequaled in any organization other than in the U.S. military, and I'm very biased because of my service. But when you look at our aircraft carriers, for example, arguably the most complex and sophisticated system that the military operates, the average age that delivers that capability from the flight deck is 19 years old. The responsibility they have, the ability that they can make judgments, shape other people's lives, is absolutely extraordinary. So there's the opportunity for leadership. But also, particularly for the generation with whom we're dealing today, the opportunities to serve, and Lloyd has it right. We oftentimes, people will think that the millennials are very self-centered and do not have that broader interest, and there could be nothing further from the truth. We have mounted several proactive humanitarian missions. A couple of hospital ship missions to Southeast Asia. In fact, the Mercy is back in Southeast Asia again. Some amphibious ships in South America, and the commitment of service and contribution that young people get from those experiences is extraordinary. But I do believe that the structure and the policies that we have for our young people in military today is really a function of a conscript force of many, many decades ago, actually. We've been able to adapt it, to morph it, and enjoy, as a result of that, some good enlistment rates and good re-enlistment rates. But as we look to the future, young people today are much more interested in geographic stability. They are much more interested in the work-life balance, or one could say life-work balance, as they may look through that lens. That does not mean that they are any less committed to the job and to their mission, extraordinarily committed. But those are things that we have to take into account, the ability for someone to come into the military and move out and then come back in. And I think those are areas that we have to explore to attract and recruit and retain young people who can make a difference, not just for our nation, but in the world.
I just want to amplify a little bit on that point, which I think is extremely important. What, in my school, we're seeing young people who are a little further along in their careers. They're not the 18 or 19-year-olds who are first going in, but the mid-20-year-olds. And this issue about balance, and especially family, which I think is a really big challenge right now. A lot of the things we've been talking about in transformation in terms of the role of the military means the idea of an accompanied tour is becoming less and less a model. We don't have as many overseas bases. People don't go over. They don't bring their families with them anymore. We're depending heavily on the reserves and multiple rotations. We have a lot of young people in our school who are reservists, and they're having to be separated from their families multiple occasions. And we're going to have to address this. I mean, it's simply a reality that if we want to both attract and keep the right people, we have to find a way to meet their needs. And some of it has to do with sizing. Some of it has to do with the way we think about the roles of families, of especially when they're a couple, both of whom are in the service, and really begin to adapt to recognize that the stresses that this new role of the military place make it particularly difficult for people to say, well, I can still have the family, I can see my spouse, I can see the kids, I can have an opportunity to pursue some other things that will be useful to me that round out my life. And I think it's a very stressing environment for that.
So, Bob?
Yeah, I just want to add that when you talk about transformation, one of the things that's being transformed is there's more and more power in the role of junior officers and senior non-commissioned officers, because we're in an area of unit size, of platoon size warfare. And what that means is you can have corporals or sergeants or master sergeants or young second lieutenants making decisions on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan that have strategic consequences depending upon how they act. So, so a whole military can turn on the behavior of a young person in a multitasking environment where not only does he have a weapon on him, but he has two or three radio systems that he's wearing, where he has to communicate, back to his company element, et cetera, and make a quick decision. So the quality of people, we're entering an age of warfare where the quality of non-commissioned officers and junior officers is more important than it's ever been in a comparable way.
And if I could just follow up on that, there's the added responsibilities and authorities that go with that level of warfare, but there are also changes that must take place at the top. Let me just rewind my career, if you would. Serving in fairly complex surface ships where you would go into the combat information center, kind of the Star Wars room where there are a lot of displays and the radios are going off. And as in any profession, you walk into an environment in which you have been trained and grown up, and you can rapidly assimilate the stimuli and you get a picture of what's going on. But in today's technology, when I walk into that room now, it is deathly quiet. I still see the displays, but I hear clicking of keys as multiple chat rooms are in play. So as a senior commander, how are you able to know what's moving beneath you, that the right decisions are being made, without slowing down the process? Because warfare today is about speed of effect and speed of decision making. And the victor will be that individual or that unit that enjoys the decision superiority. So how do you harness this? How do you not put a speed brake on the young people who are doing their work, but that you can pull that together and effectively conduct operations? And that's the environment that we have today. And I would submit that it's a precursor to the speed of effects and decision-making that we're going to have in the future.
Given that environment for the foreseeable future, Jim, what should the military be doing now to prepare this generation for that type of environment, but also to include the potential for cyber warfare or on other warfares that have yet to emerge, as I think Bob mentioned in his opening comments?
Well, I do think a lot of it has to do with sort of taking advantage of the tremendous sophistication and skills that this generation has and learning how to learn from them. mean, I think that in many ways we have a pedagogic model that says, well, you know, the older guys teach the younger guys what to do. But in fact, more and more, they are better able to do the kind of adaptation to develop the new ideas. We're seeing this in Iraq. I mean, it's been quite remarkable. I'm sure you've seen it, Admiral, that a lot of these sort of the innovations and how to adapt to the situation, how to use the information, how to make that environment work has come from the young people who are drawing on their civilian life experience and developing strategies to, you know, adapt the kind of the communication devices they have, the information processing devices that they have, which are actually much better on the civilian side in many cases than what we're providing them in terms of equipment, and to try to find an environment in which they're encouraged to do that. I mean, there's obviously got to be oversight and accountability, but the more they feel that, the more they feel that they can be participants, because this is a generation that is not very comfortable with working in a hierarchical environment. They're not taking answers and say, well, I work my way up, and after 20 years, I'll get to be finally influential. Meanwhile, I just salute and take orders. They are innovators. They believe in collaboration. They're not individualists who are just going off anonymously and working individually, but they're used to a horizontal networked environment in which they learn from each other, they share with each other, and people kind of lose that sense of hierarchy in the cyber world. So we have to bring them in. We have to find ways, as the Admiral said, to allow people to think about careers that aren't a 30-year career in the military, where they might go out and then develop skills outside and then come back again. But to see this as a strength, and really it is in the long term, our ability to deal with our adversaries who are very good at this, to take this generation who is so innovative, so adaptable and entrepreneurial, and bring those strengths in and encourage them so they will both give us their value added, but also so they'll feel empowered and have a sense of wanting to get something out of this in terms of their own lives.
Your comment or your response raises another question. The military of today isn't just the millennials, it's also Gen Xers and the baby boomers. In a 2000 study of Army captains who had attrited, one of the reasons that was most cited was sort of the work-life balance challenges, Admiral, that you mentioned, but also not addressing their growth and aspirations, if you will. Bob, what should the military be doing along the lines of managing this multi-generational workforce?
Well, I've seen this teaching at the Naval Academy where everyone takes notes with computers and is emailing each other the whole time and is very comfortable with doing 10 things at once, so to speak. I think the military is slowly adapting to this. You know, militaries are generally conservative organizations, and they adapt to change very slowly. But I think as you get younger officers promoted and become majors and lieutenant colonels and et cetera, the culture will gradually change. And I think the biggest change agent has been the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, because of all the early mistakes made, has fast-forwarded change, and the ability to question, to question decisions and other things. I think the biggest transformational element in the military is just the side effect of the war in Iraq, particularly in the Army. You know, it's particularly true in the Army, where the Army went for, I don't know how many captains and lieutenants said to me, they didn't train me for this. You know, and not just Iraq, they didn't train me to be a mayor of a small town in Kosovo. They didn't train me to be, to deal with villagers and digging a water well in Afghanistan and this. This isn't what we studied. And the real heart and soul of a military is the stronger a curriculum at the war colleges and the service academies evolves, the stronger that military is. And what you have is captains and majors and younger officers coming back to the Army War College at Carlisle, to the Naval War College in Newport and other places with lessons learned to reinvigorate curriculums. So I think this is ongoing.
Admiral, you mentioned the efforts around the tsunami, the disaster relief. Bob pointed to the roles of being mayors and things that our soldiers didn't feel they were prepared for. When you couple that with size implications, or what should the proper size of a U.S. military be, not pinging on the Army National Guard in times of stress. What's your response to that? What should the size of our U.S. military be, given all these demands?
Well, I think that what we have seen in the last few years is that that the ground war has proven to be much more personnel intensive than forecast, and a sizing of the forces for these conflicts clearly is appropriate. And one thing that many people do not realize is that I have 15,000 sailors on the ground in the Middle East. These are sailors that are performing support functions for the ground forces. Half of the U.S.-led provisional reconstruction teams in Afghanistan are led by Navy officers. So as Bob said, it's a very different environment than what they saw when they came in the Navy. But we are becoming a better Navy because of those experiences. But to get to your sizing question, particularly as it applies to the Navy, I think the nation has to decide whether it is a nation of global interests, and that will the maritime force, the naval force, and as Bob said, the Navy and the Marine Corps in particular, be sized to be able to be that global force. And the advantages to that, from my perspective, and I'm glad that Bob was saying such great things about the Navy and Marine Corps, and I haven't paid him to do any of that. But, you know, we have the advantage of being there but not really being there, that we can be offshore in an area, not infringing on the sensitivities of sovereignty that I believe will become more acute in the future, but yet to have that capability. For example, when we were doing the tsunami relief effort in Aceh, which was arguably the heaviest hit of the areas, the number of people that were left on the ground in Indonesia each night was normally less than 100, because we were very mindful of that, but we could pull back to the sea. And our ability to come from the sea with significant capability, I believe, is something that will serve the nation and future coalitions very well. You'd expect me to say that because of the suit that I'm wearing. But it really does give us that opportunity to be there but not be there, to be able to project power and yet be able to hold that power in reserve if, in fact, that's what's required by our leadership.
But I think it raises a very important question about what role should we expect our military personnel to do. And frankly, I don't think that's the highest and best use of well-trained military people to be mayors of small towns in Kosovo. And the problem has been that we've provided, in relative terms, quite a lot of resources to the military. So when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And when you need to deploy somebody and you need a mayor, if the only personnel that you have are military, then by default, they're the ones who have to do it. We've got our balance wrong, in my judgment, in terms of our resourcing the civilian side of these efforts. We need to be able to have deployable civilian forces to be mayors, to be policemen, to be teachers and the like. But we don't have that. We don't have a reserve on the civilian side. We don't have a part of our foreign service which is a part of the stabilization and society building forces, and we need to invest in that. And you hear Secretary Gates talking about this all the time. It's critically important, and we need to get Congress to understand that the best thing we can do for our military, if we really want to support them, is to relieve them of some of these responsibilities, allow them to focus on what their comparative advantage is, and to develop these complementary capabilities.
Jim, your response conjures up the need to win the next war. What do you need to have in place? Certainly there's the military side of things, but now you're introducing the whole civilian side as well. How do you think millennials play into that, given their, at least what we know of their attributes today?
I think that there's a real opportunity because, you know, I don't see it from a statistical point of view. I see it from an anecdotal point of view. But I see a generation which is highly motivated to make a difference, that care a lot about other people and doing other things. It's a very globalized generation. They have a very strong sense of our connection to the rest of the world. And so they're out there. They're doing things in the world. They see their fate as intertwined with others. And so they're motivated to be involved in these things. And they're motivated to have a sense of being able to contribute both in their own communities in the United States, but also abroad, to making a difference. So I think if we were out there recruiting in a broader sense of national service, not just for the military, but to perform some of these other functions, to be out there in a kind of a 21st century equivalent of the Peace Corps, to think about how you can help dealing with problems of global public health and education in conflict societies, to be working hand in hand with our military, that you'd find a tremendous responsiveness. This is a generation which has a strong sense of social responsibility, strong sense of living in a globalized environment, and wanting to be part of that. So I think there's tremendous opportunities here.
Bob? Yeah, I think we make too big a distinction between combat deployments like Fallujah and humanitarian relief deployments like the tsunami and domestic deployments like Katrina and foreign deployments like Afghanistan. For the military, increasingly on an expeditionary pace, the future is fluidity. It's one deployment flowing into the next. And again, anecdotally, what Marines tell me is, yeah, they would much rather be in Fallujah, because that's what Marines are and do. But they'd rather be in the, you know, helping people in the tsunami than back home just training. You know, as long as they're deployed somewhere, as long as they're involved in an operation somewhere, that's what really motivates them. And I think you see this in the reenlistment rates, is that the more deployed people have been, up to a point that is, I mean, there's, you know, a bit of a bell curve here, up to a point that there is, the reenlistment rates are very good.
Right. Given the fluidity you mentioned, what capabilities and systems need to be in place to facilitate and to help our soldiers on the ground? And from your experience, do we have plans in place to provide those systems and capabilities?
Well, I think a key thing for the future is to interact better with NGOs. You know, not for all deployments, and certainly not for classic combat deployments. For instance, if we got involved in a land campaign of some sort or another, like North Korea, if the regime were to collapse, would be the world's greatest humanitarian catastrophe, and we would have to interface with the Chinese People's Liberation Army, with the South Korean military, etc. But for a lot of deployments, the military has to, increasingly get better at dealing with NGOs, and that's a cultural problem for both the military and also for the NGO community, which can often, harbor negative stereotypes about the military. So it's a learning process on both sides.
Mm-hmm. If I could follow up on that, if you would have asked me 5 years ago whether or not NGOs would be embarked in big gray Navy ships, I would have said, good idea, not likely. Well, that's exactly what's happening. A breakthrough event really was the tsunami. But then we realized, as Bob said, that's the future. So we moved very quickly and saw not just the compelling humanitarian need to get back into the region that had been so devastated with the tsunami, but we also said if we go back, we really need to do that, not just as the U.S. military. So we reached out to some of our friends in the region who supported us with some incredible capability that they had. But then 11 NGOs said, sure, we'll go along. And, of course, this was on a hospital ship. It's white, has a big red cross on it. But then the next year we said, we're going to take a large amphibious ship and we're going to put some engineering equipment on it. Would you like to come? And the answer was yes. And every humanitarian assistance mission since that time has been U.S., foreign military, and NGO. And that's the future. I couldn't agree more with Bob.
I think it's important, though, because this is the real world that we're seeing now, that we don't forget that there is something else going on, too, which is the high-end side. And it's still an important part of what's going on. It's important. First of all, it consumes a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of planning, and it's an understandable amount of planning in the military for the stressful big enemy again. And although nobody likes to say it, everybody's thinking China. And I think it's very important as we think about going forward how we think about that problem as well, because there's a danger in this situation, because our military is so dominant, that it always wants to stay the one step ahead. And although we don't have that threat, that peer threat right now, we don't want it to emerge, and so we want to keep that capabilities edge. And at the same time that we do it, we run the risk that other people will see this as a threat to them. And so we're running this very difficult balance now, which is how much to invest in the potential of an emergence of a real peer competitor who could deal with us on the high end, as well as dealing with all these complex lower-end contingencies. We're spending a lot of money to develop a next-generation fighter now, which is dealing with an enemy which has not yet emerged. We're investing an enormous amount in space military capabilities to deal with that potential. And that takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of the focus on these other things. And trying to get that balance right across all the things we're talking about here remains one of the biggest challenges.
But there's also a mixing, too, because it's easy to go high-end, low-end. But the proliferation that's taking place has changed it's changed the definition of asymmetry. When we used to talk about asymmetric warfare before, it was kind of at the low end, or what we call the low end. But now, in every band of that spectrum, there's asymmetry. When you get into the high end, the activities that take place in cyber warfare are pretty complex. They also take place at the very low end. 2 years ago, the Israelis were not expecting a very sophisticated surface-to-air missile to be shot at them by Hezbollah. But that's what happened, and it almost sank one of their ships. So the landscape in which we will deal is not going to be as black and white. That's why it's important for those who serve in the military to understand that landscape. And as Jim pointed out, regardless of what we would like the world to be, warfare and combat is going to be gritty, it is going to be ugly, and young people will die. And that's the nature of war. So how do we best prepare them for that? And how do we attract people into that environment? But we see it day in and day out of how young people can work. I talked about the number of sailors I have on the ground. Anecdote. Convoy in Iraq had a nuclear machinist mate, someone who works on the nuclear reactors and one of our most advanced nuclear submarines, was on one of these assignments in Iraq. He was in a convoy that was hit. All of the vehicles were disabled. His skills allowed him to get out, restore the vehicles, and get the convoy moving and out of danger. So how do you train someone for that? But the main takeaway is that there are young men and women who are willing to do it. As I've said, over half of my Navy has enlisted after 9/11. And to me, that's the brightest spot as I look to the future.
Admiral, I'd like to stick with you. In your opening comments, you mentioned your desire for the Navy, but the military at large, to fit the nation demographically. From our research on millennials, they are a very ethnically diverse group of individuals. What is the military going to do to adapt to this type of generation, but then even more so as they advance through the military to encourage or to promote that?
Well, I think one of the things that we must do in order to change the demographic within the military, and quite frankly, that demographic today, the numbers are not that great. It's not as if we have to go out and bring in thousands of underrepresented minorities. To get the leadership mix that we need for the size of the Navy, and speaking for my service, that we need, the numbers today are not that great. But we have to go to where we can expose underrepresented minorities to the opportunities that are available. And clearly for the Navy and for the type of warfare that I think we're going to be in the future, the need for the nation to take seriously a foundation in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, I think, is very important. But I would say that that goes beyond the military. The world we live in will be much more technologically advanced, and to feed that future force and leadership of the nation, I think that's an area that we have to concentrate on. And in fact, what we are doing in the Navy is going into universities of underrepresented minorities and realigning our Reserve Officer Training Corps units, looking at junior Reserve Officer Training Corps units, not to be drafting or recruiting in there, but simply to expose young people to the opportunities that are available.
Fantastic. Thank you. At this point, I'd like to open it up to the floor to ask questions. I believe we'll have microphones, and so if you could please state who you are, where you're from, and then the question, that would be great.
Morning. I'm George Kay. I'm a local resident. Question for the entire panel. Assume we can overcome the political problems that the next administration and Congress would have in reviving a universal military draft. Does the panel feel that that would benefit our armed forces and our security?
Okay. Bob?
I'll take a first crack at that. I think there are a lot of problems with a universal draft. Number one, the military feels itself as part of an elite warrior force. And a draft would undermine that. Secondly, if you only have, because warfare is increasingly technologically complex, the time to train people, you know, to do things takes longer. So if you only have people for 2 or 3 years, you know, it becomes a cost, a cost-effective problem. Thirdly, if you have a draft, you'd get a two-tier military. You'd get an elite at the top who are volunteers for their life, basically making all the decisions, and then draftees under the bottom. So those are three problems I see with a draft, or three challenges.
Bob and I think, are very aligned on this. The complexity at a technological level, the importance, I believe, of our military personnel to be able to operate effectively in diverse cultures. So how, in a very short period of time, can you get a force that has those competencies? And as I look around the world, there is more of a drive toward an all-volunteer force, toward a more professionalized force, that you can make those investments in, that you can attain the competencies and the capacity that you need. So I know that that's something talked about frequently, but for the future that I see, I do not believe that's the solution.
I basically share the view, but I'm a strong believer in universal national service, and I do think that this is a critical moment with this generation, which should be very responsive. And I think, obviously, the military would be one option there. I think we really need to find a way to connect our young people with this broader sense of giving back and being involved with their community, and to make the military an important part of that overall effort.
Great. Given the lines behind each mic, we're going to do two at a time like the previous session. So, ma'am?
Okay. I'm Mary Forster. I'm with the Boeing Company. And the question is for the members of the panel. You briefly touched on jointness and the great progress that's been made over the last 20 years in having the different branches of our services work more closely together. Do you see a time in the future when we will be able to share some of our enabling technologies with allies so that global force projection can really be a worldwide cooperative event, undertaking rather than just a U.S. undertaking?
Thank you.
My name is Gary Lauder. I'm a Silicon Valley venture capitalist, and my question pertains to public diplomacy. We spend a great deal of money trying to defeat our enemies rather than trying to make fewer of them. And so my hypothesis is that if we spend 1% of our military budget on public diplomacy and other things like that, it might be more efficacious, and I'd appreciate the panel's comments on that.
Great. Bob, why don't you start with the sharing with our allies in the area of joint?
Well, you know, what it gets to is something even more, is that we can develop systems, you know, and developing, as you know, a new plane, a new strategic bomber, you know, or a new destroyer or something, it can take decades. I mean, really. And with cost overruns, because everyone wants to put every weapon system available on it, because nobody wants to be blamed, so there'll be no risk. And then, you know, for fewer cents on the dollar, our adversaries can build something cheaper that gets the job, you know, that can get the job done. What I'm thinking of is like Iranians on jet skis shooting at a U.S. frigate in the Persian Gulf. You know, even if they did minor damage, the publicity value of it, could be very high. What I meant was Iranian jet skis with shoulder-fired missiles or something like that. So, that's the critical issue. Are we becoming so overburdened with developing these vast systems that take so long to get into place that they're, they don't live out their usefulness? If we're going to build a new Ford-class aircraft carrier or a new strategic bomber, that piece of equipment has to work for several decades in the field for it to be useful in the first place. And it becomes more and more a threat, from another country attacking us asymmetrically. But I think, as you saw with the aerial tanker deal, foreign companies investing in our defense, in our defense posture, are part of the future. No matter who gets that contract eventually, we're going to see more bids from Europe and elsewhere to help us develop our systems. And because companies are implicitly multinational now, implicitly worldwide, it's going to be less and less of a pure U.S. product.
Jim, you want to address the public policy?
Sure. I think it's an absolutely right point that there's a lot of high value things that we could do for relatively small amount of resources compared to what we have to spend on our military that have huge impacts on our overall national security. The only thing I caution about public diplomacy, I always get worried that public diplomacy is storytelling rather than substance. I mean, we do have to tell our story, but we have to have the substance to support it. So when I think about what we need to do, it's more in what Joe Nye calls the soft power things, both in terms of our own actions, but also how we're being responsive to the needs and concerns of others that really allow us to undercut. It's the hearts and minds side of this, which I think is quite important. I just add a word on the sharing bit. I've been very involved in this in a number of different capacities. When Bill Cohen was the Secretary of Defense, he was very interested in trying to figure out how we could do more in sharing with our allies. And there's a trade-off, because we get, particularly with our high-end capabilities, they're very sophisticated technologies. We're very concerned for the reasons that Bob said. We invest so much money in it, we don't want the bad guys to get a hold of it. But that means we're reluctant to share. It has very, not only does it make it harder for us to work together, but it also creates bad feelings. I know the Admiral spends a lot of time in the Pacific. I was just over in Japan. The Japanese are desperate to work with us on our new fighter, the F-22, but we've had some bad experiences in terms of their security and the way they deal with information, and so it creates tensions with an ally. And I think we need to look at that balance to recognize we obviously have to protect sensitive technologies, but if we want our friends to be our friends, we have to be open to finding ways to try to overcome that.
Thank you. Sam?
This is an election year, and certainly Senator McCain's military history is probably one of his best-known traits by Americans and highly respected. My question is, would you share your observations? Should Senator Obama be in the Oval Office, it would be a very different relationship with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with someone simply with his background and his age.
Thank you. My name is Joe Becker. I work for Human Rights Watch. My question is primarily for Bob Kaplan. You began your initial remarks by talking about suicide bombers as one of the biggest transformations in the military landscape. In the last couple of years, we've seen close to a six-fold increase in the number of suicide bombings in Afghanistan by insurgents. And I'm wondering if you'd just elaborate a little bit more on what kinds of changes in military approaches and also policy approaches are needed to address this issue.
Bob, you want to start there?
Yeah, well, there's two sides to it. First is technological. We've developed all these robots and others, and detection devices, at a high cost. This is why I said suicide bombing is so effective as an asymmetric tool. I mean, we've really gotten a handle on it, but it's cost a lot of money in technological innovations to do so. But ultimately, you can't win that battle unless you turn the minds of your enemy, unless you demoralize your enemy through attrition and constant. I mean, we've seen a dramatic drop overall in suicide bombings in Iraq, you know, over the past 6 months, whatever. It's been more dramatic than anyone could have predicted a year ago or 18 months ago. And this has come not through any, like, you know, foolproof new item. It's come through just constant combat, attrition, going after these people, going after their nerve centers, going after, you know, where they develop the bombs, going after their command and control centers, you know, who's operating them, et cetera. And it's, you know, and it's been very, you know, it's been very tough work, but we finally, have made significant progress in Iraq, less so in Afghanistan, I think.
Admiral,
can you take the first one, please?
Okay.
Your military is unique in the world, and I would argue that it's the best military in the world today. I wouldn't even argue it. I'd state it bluntly. And there's something very unique about your military, is that we take an oath to a piece of paper, and we serve the Constitution of the United States. And the American people will vote, and they will elect a commander-in-chief, and the American military will serve that commander-in-chief. And that's how I see it.
Thank you. Sir?
David Williams, Seattle. In this time of rapid technological change, what changes do we need to make to the military procurement systems, which really haven't been rapidly moving in the past?
Thank you. Jim?
Hi, Jim Woolsey, Vantage Point Venture Partners and advisor to Booz Allen. End of May, there was a very interesting long article in the magazine National Journal called China's Cyber Militia. And it went into substantial detail about the degree to which the Office of the Secretary of Defense, military contractors, a lot of institutions in American life have had huge amounts of data stolen by hacking, some of it from China, some of it apparently from Russia, some perhaps from the Middle East. It is not merely a matter of information theft, but rather putting malware into systems. This article, quoting senior people from the intelligence community, said that there was some reason to believe even that the power outage in 2003 in August in the northeastern United States and eastern Canada and the power outage in February but blanked out most of East Florida were the result of Chinese hacking. The Air Force has established a cyber command, but other than that, I haven't seen a lot of what's happening in the Department of Defense to deal with this very asymmetric and I think potentially extremely effective threat, not only to steal information, but also to cause serious trouble for our whole infrastructure. Could any of you comment on what's going on?
Great. Thank you.
Lloyd, if I could, and I'm going to try and connect both together, if I could. I believe, and I alluded to cyberspace a couple of times, that's one of the significant future battlegrounds. The first battles will be fought there. The battles are ongoing there as we speak. And how we fight in that environment will be absolutely critical. We in the Navy established a command similar to the Air Force's about 4 years ago. We in the Navy moved to a singular approach so that we could better defend our networks because most of the ways in are through a lot of the legacy systems that we have. Go back to this one. Our procurement system is not responsive, is not fast enough, is not agile enough for us to be able to stay ahead of this very challenging environment. And it must change if we are to be successful in the world of cyberspace. And, oh, by the way, it's got to get fixed in the other areas as well because it just takes too bloody long to move something from an idea to a solution in a cost-effective way.
Bob?
Yeah, just quickly, there's a book called The Collapse of Complex Societies by an archaeologist, Joseph Tainter. And he talks about the Mayas and others, and it could apply to the U.S., you know, to the Washington bureaucracy. It's that when societies are successful and they go on long enough, they build up multi-layers of bureaucracy where it gets harder and harder to get anything done and harder to implement anything, and then it gradually crumbles and decays. And I don't think there's a better example of this than the procurement process for big-ticket items, which are normally in the Navy and the Air Force. And just the years it takes. I mean, how many years have we been working on the DDX?
Well, the normal period from concept approval to ship in the water is about 14 years. Far too long. Far too long. We're about ready to deliver a ship in about 5 years. It has not been without its issues. But to me, when that ship goes to sea next month, it in and of itself, if we did it in 5 years, it would be a step in the right direction.
Shelley Friedstein, Goldman Sachs. There was an article the other day in the paper. It was a comment by Iran in response to numerous threats, but they spoke of their ability to close the Straits of Hormuz, in which 40% of the world's oil passes through. The Navy made a comment that they felt they could keep the Straits of Hormuz open in response to that. I'd like to know probabilities and your comment, please.
My comment.
One more question, and then getting the proverbial hook. So this will have to be, unfortunately, the last question.
Bill Cabanis from Birmingham, Alabama. Early in the session, I think I heard the statistic, very astonishing but very disturbing, that only 28% of our young people qualify for service in our militaries. Could you tell us about the 72% that don't qualify? What are the primary reasons why they don't qualify?
The primary reasons are medical, health, and legal issues. As you have seen, there's been some discussion, debate about the waivers that the military uses. And it is very important to get to the type of military that we need for the future, that we have to have that quality control. But we as a nation, I believe, have to address that 72% so that we can open it up. It is an astounding number.
And while you have the floor?
While I have the floor, it's my job to keep that straight open. And I have great confidence in our Navy and in our partners in the region to do just that.
I would like to thank our panelists for engaging on this topic, as well as you all.